Hello, and welcome to the Off the Table podcast. We are a group of global health enthusiasts from diverse backgrounds who deeply care about improving access to surgery worldwide and believe that the solutions come from the ground up. Your hosts, Amuna, Reem, Paul, and myself, Emily, will aim to create a safe environment to have comfortable and uncomfortable conversations about equitable surgery. We aim to be impactful by sending a concrete and evidence-based call to action after each conversation. We truly hope you enjoy these conversations as much as we do.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to episode 6 of Off the Table. My name is Paul, and my co-host today is Emily. On this episode of Off the Table, we are excited to have Dr. Abebe Bekele, founding dean of the School of Medicine and deputy vice chancellor at the University of Global Health and Equity in Rwanda, and champion of global surgical care and surgical education. Welcome, Dr. Bekele.
Thank you so much, Paul. Thank you for having me.
So, Abebe, we always start with the same questions to all our guests, and it's a pretty basic question, but we like to hear our guest's journey, you know, where they come from, where they grew up, and then what really sparked their passions in becoming doctors, surgeons. And in your case, a little bit more maybe about how, you know, your journey evolved from being a clinician to really being an academician and a professor in your current role. So if you could just walk us through that, that'd be great.
Thank you so much, Emily. Yes, I am born and raised in Ethiopia, Addis Ababa. I did my elementary and high schools at the St. Joseph School in Addis Ababa. Then I joined the then Gondar College of Medical Sciences, now University of Gondar, to do my undergrad medical degree. Then came back to Addis, to the Addis Ababa University School of Medicine to do my residency in general surgery, and then my subspecialty training in cardiothoracic surgery. Then I also did a fellowship program in medical education at the Femer Institute in Philadelphia. A few leadership programs in the US and in Ethiopia. In 2011-12, I was asked to basically serve as Associate Dean of Undergraduate at the School of Medicine. I did this job for a few years, then became the Dean of the School of Medicine at Addis Ababa University. In addition, the responsibility of being CEO of the largest hospital in the country, the Black Lion Hospital, was also given to me. In 2017, I left that position, went on my sabbatical, then joined the newly established university in Rwanda, known as the University of Global Health Equity, in May of 2018. As you said, Paul, I now serve as the Dean of the School of Medicine, and I also double as the Deputy Vice Chancellor of Academic and Research Affairs here. Emily, your second question is about why surgery? Well, let me start by answering why I'm a medical doctor. I am the last born in the family. My sister and my brother went to medical school before me. So naturally, I had to be a doctor. I didn't know what I was getting into. So I scored good mark, my high school results, went into medicine. That's just it. The honest response is that. But once I joined, I realized that the profession had meaning. I loved what I did. And when I entered clinical medicine at year 3, in that medical school, 3 young, freshly graduate surgeons joined the university as teaching faculty. And these were the inspiration behind me to show me the road towards a life, a career in surgery. These are really dedicated people, dedicated teachers, dedicated caregivers, really gifted surgeons who really were role models to me and many of my friends in my School of Medicine then. So that's why I fell in love with surgery. My grades, my marks also in surgery, my internship were also very good. So naturally, when I graduated with a very great distinction in the School of Medicine, I was invited to join that university as lecturer in the Department of Surgery. I served there for almost 2.5 years, then went into my residency in general surgery. After I did my general surgery residency, then there were only 2 thoracic surgeons in Ethiopia, significantly older than I was. And then one discussion led to another, I had to make the decision of following their footprint and be a young cardiothoracic surgeon because the need was enormous. Cardiac surgery did not exist in the country. Even if it did, you know, patchy procedures here and there. Thoracic surgery were only two for the whole of, you know, yet then about 70 million people. The waiting list was beyond 2 years. So we decided to set up a local fellowship program in partnership with institutions in the US, in Canada, and in India. I did my 3.5 years training in cardiothoracic surgery and became a cardiothoracic surgery in 2009. In back at the Addis Ababa University. So this is my academic journey in short.
That's fascinating. I'll just poke a little bit more. Like, I know there's a need for cardiothoracic surgery in Ethiopia. Is that also a passion of yours in terms of, you know, the specialty itself, or you just wanted to fill a gap by choosing that path?
Mainly the need in the country. Someone has to do it. There was interest around orthopedic surgery, plastic surgery, urology. The field was flourishing in Ethiopia, but not so much in cardiothoracic surgery. So, some young people, a few young people, had to do it. It's not easy. It's really difficult. The path was not smooth, but someone had to do it. As I started engaging myself in cardiothoracic surgery, the thoracic and mediastinal part really absorbed me a lot. So I now call myself a thoracic and a mediastinal surgery than cardiac. After three of us, now there are several locally trained cardiothoracic surgeons in the country.
I wanted to ask you about your role in helping establish the University of Global Health and Equity in Rwanda. Obviously, this was a massive undertaking and a tremendous achievement. Could you speak to your goals for your university and some of the obstacles you faced in establishing the university and making it what it is today?
Yes, thank you, Paul. My involvement in leadership of medical school started, as I said, in 2012, associate dean, then dean and CEO. Then in 2018, I received the invitation to, if I was interested in being considered for a role of founding dean of the School of Medicine at UGHE. Then I asked myself a couple of questions. Number one, how many of us can say I helped open a new medical school? This is an opportunity you cannot pass, especially in this part of the world, in Africa, where more doctors are needed, quality doctors are needed. No one can say no to such an opportunity. It's history in the making. The second thing is I did a very well-structured fellowship program at the Famer Institute in Philadelphia. That gave me the foundation of what modern medical education should look like, what 21st century teaching and learning in medicine should look like, how proper curricula can be developed, important and state-of-the-art teaching methodologies, strategies, how you use resources, and how you prepare young people to tackle the 21st century diseases in this part of the world. So I considered myself trained. When this opportunity came, this also gave me the opportunity to implement what I knew, what I learned. And it's exactly what we tried to do. Myself and my colleagues, my partners, over the past 3.5 years, we tried to establish a good medical school with a really good curricula, well-selected students, well-implemented curricula, and our students have now entered the clinical year. So that's why I joined UGHE.
That's really phenomenal. And I think probably we'll have to take this online because I'd like to ask you lots of questions about curriculum development. It's something we don't necessarily have the training for here, despite, you know, being teachers and academic training programs. And I think that's really brilliant that you've established that. We've heard that in July 2019, you welcomed the inaugural class medical students who were 2/3 women. Is that true?
Yes. Amazing. By policy, we recruit 70% women in the medical school.
By policy, amazing. So congratulations for that. That's very exciting. And then, of course, the pandemic hit and everybody had to kind of shift gears and adapt to the new reality. I know you've spoken a lot in different webinars about this, but can you maybe give us a few examples of the challenges that has actually created for medical education in your university and how you had to navigate that?
Yes, thank you, Emily. I can start from student recruitment. The medical students in Africa are fresh out of high school. So selection depends on their success in high schools. Unfortunately, because of COVID, national licensing examinations were delayed significantly. That means we did not have enough pool of students from Rwanda, from the neighboring countries, to join our programs. That is why our intake was delayed by 7 months. Again, the ripple effect is going to delay our next intake by additional four to five months. That has been a big blow to the schedule we've put in 2018. Mm-hmm. The second is almost the entire world went into lockdown. And Rwanda is a very strict country. We managed the pandemic very well. One of the measures implemented was medical schools, hospitals, were significantly restricted. That means almost all our face-to-face teaching had to be converted to online. We were lucky. We invested at the beginning, at the formation of the School of Medicine, on good infrastructure, on IT. And we managed to convert most of our contents to online. And we used the entire year of 2020 to rapidly develop courses as they happen. And within 2 weeks, we completely converted from face-to-face to completely online. We did not miss any academic days, any academic year. That has been a big success for us. Unfortunately, this comes at a challenge. Our cadaveric dissection sessions had to be canceled. Face-to-face laboratory teaching has to be canceled. Face-to-face simulation teaching has to be canceled. And luckily, our students were not yet into clinical teaching. That would have also been significantly restricted. Another challenge is resources were not easy to find during COVID. You have to visit supermarkets. You have to visit markets. Faculty and visiting faculty have to travel, to Rwanda. Our faculty, our staff had to travel for training, to share experience with partner institutions. That did not happen. And mainly our partner institutions did not manage to share their faculty with us. The silver lining is e-learning, Zoom-based classes sessions became very rampant. We became experts in Zoom-based webinars, seminars, flipped classroom sessions, didactic teaching. So that has been the silver lining of COVID.
It's really impressive that you guys were able to stay open, and just a testament to how much work you put into the university. I'm currently applying to med school, and I know it's a long process, but one of my thoughts with this, with going forward in the COVID era, I was just curious, how were you guys able to teach clinical skills, like physical exams on Zoom and stuff like that specifically? Mm-hmm. I know that must be challenging, not being able to meet face-to-face at times as these lockdowns continue.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. The good thing is during the hot pandemic period, our students were doing basic medical sciences. We did not suffer much in terms of restriction to clinical medicine. Our students went to the bridging course, Introduction to Medicine, last October. By then, restrictions were significantly lifted. We had clear access to the hospital, so we did not suffer a lot. But during the basic medical sciences teaching, our students were supposed to be exposed to clinical teaching a little bit. That couldn't be done. We had to change to virtual model. We tried virtual simulation. We tried virtual laboratory sessions. We tried case-based collaborative learning with clinicians through Zoom. That went beautifully. But as you can imagine, medicine is a skill, an art, and a science. The art component of medicine, palpation, talking to patients, understanding their feeling, that we need to compensate as we move forward.
No, I agree, everything. I can't agree more. I think it's really hard to teach that virtually. And patient contact, I think, is a huge part of medicine. And our medical students have suffered We have been forced to actually cancel a lot of shadowing days where medical students were able actually to follow us around and just see, you know, what being a surgeon is like or being an internist is like, and kind of think about what they wanted to do moving forward and see how that worked out in real life. And that has not been possible. So I think at least one or two cohorts of medical students will suffer from a lack of exposition, and I'm concerned to see what's going to happen moving forward with that, like in terms of their ability to, you know, I'm sure they'll catch up, but it's going to be harder.
Yeah,
I just wanted to go back to this 70%, policy of female and male applicants in medical school. And as a female surgeon, we know there's not a lot of us. And we know very well also that there's this phenomenon of female disappearance in academic medicine, meaning we start as basically the majority of the cohorts. And that's the same, I think, most places in the world. And then as you move to residency, you move to fellowship programs, you move to academic medicine, such as being division heads, department heads, deans of school medicines, then the women disappear. And maybe I think there's probably four or five deans of medical schools across the world. Do you have any opinion on that, or like any thought about like being a champion of gender equity, how we can actually support women throughout their careers to actually get to those leadership positions and not disappear?
Thank you. Thanks, Emily. Yes, you are absolutely right. It's like an inverted pyramid in the rest of the world.
Yeah.
The number of women in medical school is relatively large, but as they progress up in the careers, the number decreases significantly. That's even worse in Africa. So the problem is, I think, obvious to all of us. The solution, I think, should be also obvious, is to do something about it. Not to write about it more, not to, not to publish about it, but to act on it. So what we decided was, if we don't have enough women doctors in Africa, we should train more. It's a direct, pragmatic policy solution. And as they, as women students develop in the career, the solution is to create this support structure around them that keeps them going, that helps them finish medical school, concentrate on further education based on their own choice. It can be public health, it can be surgery, it can be medicine, subspecialty, whatever degree of leadership they want to reach at. So UGHE wanted to take a pragmatic solution. Increase the number of women intake in medical school and create the support structure. By support structure, we mean a very good mentorship program. Through our Center for Gender Equity, we set up a program called Women Mentorship Program. All our women students are given international mentors from Rwanda and from around the globe. These are our friends, partners who support them. We relatively have a good student services program that takes care of their medical needs, psychosocial needs, and other personal needs. And hopefully, as they enter clinical year, this support will continue. We believe in accompaniment, and that, I think, will give a good solution to the problem we are in globally. But personally, I am convinced talking about more or publishing about it will not give us a solution. We need to act about it.
I agree. I don't think any of us want to read another paper on gender inequity and this inverted pyramid. We know those numbers well. In terms of like medical students, it seems like you already have a path and pragmatic solutions, but how about promoting your own faculty, your own colleagues, and for women who are already in their careers to actually keep moving up instead of stagnating? And I'll just give an example of a pragmatic solution. Actually, I came across this last week. We have big Canadian grants called the CIHR, anyway, for researchers. But what I found really interesting is that they have this particular policy where for women who took maternity leave, they actually will extend your period of application for your grant by double the time that you took your maternity leave. So, you know, if you take a year off to have a baby, then you get granted 2 years of basically a pass to still be you know, in the competition to actually apply for the same grants as men who would not have had to take a leave. And I found that this was a pretty pragmatic solution because having children myself, I know it's hard to actually completely catch up when you come back from a break and to just go straight back into being a productive researcher and you miss deadlines and this becomes very tricky. So I guess that's just an example of something pragmatic that could be helpful for somebody who's already in career. Have you, you know, kind of created those mechanisms for your own peers and colleagues in Rwanda or Ethiopia where you've worked?
Thanks, Emily. Yes, let me discuss two of the initiatives we set up here at UGHE. The first one is what we call the Junior Fellows Program. This is a program where we recruit young Rwandans and Africans to join UGHE as junior faculty, as lecturers. And then through this program, we want to support them develop through advanced training. If they want to do residency, if they want to do PhD programs, UGHE is in the process of supporting them do those advanced trainings, bring them back when they are ready, and take them through the senior faculty position. And hopefully, these young people we recruit will reach at a certain level of leadership within a few years' time. This, I'm talking about UGHE, an institution that's led by a female vice chancellor, and almost half of our academic leads are women. From 6 of the 10 division chairs and heads are women. So it already is an institution that fosters, that supports women in leadership positions. The second one is what we call the Dean's Research Grant. Small, but available to almost all faculty on competition-based, first-come, first-served basis. We foster the culture of research and make small funding available for faculty who come in groups, as teams of researchers. The third is our very famous Young Women Mentorship Program. So far, more than 100 women have passed through the system. Our Center of Gender Equity is leading that. And these are three programs that we already have in place. I'm sure more will come soon. The COVID epidemic did not do us any favors in implementing some of them. We had the habit, the culture of sending our young faculty abroad to our partner institutions to spend some weeks, some months there, come prepared with better competency, better education, and implement what they have learned. Just to give you an example, two of our young female faculty who serve at our simulation center spent 2 months in Boston to learn about simulation in basic medical science and clinical medicine. Now they are doing a fantastic job after they came back from that training.
Amazing. Thank you.
Thank you. One of the things in doing the research about some of the work that you've done that caught my eye in particular was that the curriculum that you helped establish at the medical school starts not with health sciences, but with 6 months of African history and coursework on human rights, gender studies, and social justice. Program like this is essential to improving healthcare in basically all countries, particularly here in Canada, where I do think we have some big gaps. What inspired you to develop the curriculum this way? And have you seen some of the benefits so far with some of the class already?
Thank you, Paul. Our curriculum is structured into 4 phases. The first one is called the preparatory phase, where our students do 7 modules, mainly about humanities, social sciences, medical anthropology, African history, political economy, gender equity and social justice, and community-based education, in addition to IT and English. We strongly believe our future doctors need to understand their origin, where they came from, and why they are here. If you are a religious person, it might not be, wrong to say God created you for a reason. Especially in this part of the world, for a reason. You are getting this opportunity of being a medical doctor in Africa for a reason. What is that reason? What kind of people are you going to serve? What is the socioeconomic status of the people you are living with, you're serving? What does underprivileged mean? Why should you resist the urge to migrate out of Africa and serve the poor here? Those foundations can be laid down initially by the humanities and the social sciences. Medical humanities also encourage professionals to grasp this professional values, behaviors, the professional identity formation is underpinned by this training. What is unique about Africa? What is unique about the land we're living in? The humanities also help medical students and professionals in their communication skill, in their sense of teamwork, in their understanding of what leadership is. We hope our trainees will serve Africa in the region as tomorrow's leaders. So that foundation is laid by such an academic program. They would also help them develop their skills in reading, learning, understanding, and memorizing. For all of us, English is not our first language. So support in the English language is very important to pursue a career in medicine. And most importantly, what do we mean by the social determinants of diseases? Almost all diseases have strong linkage to the community. COVID is a good example. The outcome is really bad in certain communities, and certain communities do very well. Why is that? Why are cancers more common in certain communities? And why is their outcome really bad? And why do certain communities fare very well? What does access mean? The disparities in access. What is the social underpinning? So such understandings, the foundation is laid down by such academic programs. And we strongly believe that any medical profession without this background knowledge is probably not ready for 21st century challenges in front of them.
I was just kind of chatting with Paul as you were speaking. I didn't get any of that training in medical school. Zero. Nobody ever talked about social determinants of health. Yeah. Medicine is medicine. Yeah. It's just, you know, anatomy and embryology and, yeah, and disease processes and medication and, you know the drill. And I think we've basically taken the human out of it. And that's extremely sad. I think for us in Canada, more and more, especially with, and I'm sure you've heard with all this attempt for truth and reconciliation with our Indigenous populations, we're trying to integrate that more and more into healthcare. But I think we're doing it a little bit backwards. So we just kind of are not really addressing it from the get-go. And I wonder if such a curriculum should be adapted to our needs here in Canada. And I guess we might talk offline about how we can look at your program, because I do believe that we need to be proud of our roots and talk about where we come from and what, you know, causes diseases that's just outside of actual, what we call medicine, Western medicine, I guess, and be absolutely a bit more thoughtful about it. We're not thoughtful about this at all.
Well, Emily, you're not alone. Me as a medical student did not take such courses. I learned on the job. I suffered the consequences. Mm-hmm. I had to wake up and do a lot of reading, a lot of attend sessions. I don't think I'm yet there yet, but I don't think my students, the youth of today, should follow the same path I did, you did. We should be able to create a better opportunity for them to tackle what's waiting for them in the future. Nobody predicted COVID would come. And who knows, is COVID-22 waiting for us? Is COVID-24 waiting for us? I don't know. We don't know. We need to make sure the youth are prepared to handle such eventualities.
Absolutely. But Paul, what are your thoughts on that?
No, I absolutely agree. And I've got, I'm a little bit older as a med school applicant. So I have a bunch of friends that have gone through already, and the kind of the onus is on them to teach themselves about the social determinants of health. And, you know, while I think it's regarded as an asset, it doesn't seem to be regarded as essential by a lot of medical schools. So that was one of the things that I just thought was so impressive, that you are taking the time in the medical school to teach all your students about everything that they'll see with their patients and why their patients have the symptoms that they do. I just think it's really important. So it's really impressive. Thank you, Dr.
I want to shift gears a little bit, still talking about education, but I assisted one of your recent webinars with different like surgical providers from all across the country talking about training mostly and decolonization. And we know that you're a strong proponent of strong and resilient training programs to develop strong and resilient health systems. And one of the things you mentioned on that webinar was training surgeons in district hospitals. I'm not sure if you remember.
Yeah, correct.
And I'm super interested in that. Here in BC, the medical school actually has a distributed learning approach where, you know, there's possibilities for medical students all the way through residency programs to actually learn in community hospitals and in more rural sites. And so what we've established, basically not we, but the medical school, is that every hospital in the province of British Columbia is actually connected and affiliated to the university. And so every hospital in this province is a potential training site for medical students and residents, which I think helps also with what we were previously talking about, the social determinants of health and knowing what can actually cause disease in different populations and with different resources and backgrounds. My question is, have you seen this type of distributed learning work in sub-Saharan Africa, and in what setting? And if not, what are the challenges to establishing such training programs in distributed sites or away from capital cities and big urban centers?
Thank you, Emily. I wear another hat at the College of Surgeons of East Central and Southern Africa. I chair the examinations and credentialing committee there. The college identified this as a big challenge to promote surgery in late 1990s and the beginning of 2000s. So when the college was started in 2000, the motto was that we need to use our district hospitals to train our surgeons for several reasons. Number one, we have more district hospitals than big city hospitals now. So we need to utilize them. Number two, in these district hospitals, the most common surgical diseases are being treated. The emergencies, the laparotomies, the fractures, the appendicitis, the tropical infections, the tropical ulcers, they end up in the district hospital. So unless we train our doctor, the surgeons there, they will not have opportunities to see them. Mm-hmm. Number three, once our trainees graduate, we want them to go back and work in a district hospital, mm-hmm. at least for a certain number of years. But we are training them in capital cities with the most advanced investigations, the most advanced surgical options and surgical infrastructure. Mm-hmm. After surgery, we want them to go back to a district hospital and work without an ultrasound, without a CT scan. We did not prepare them for that role. And number four, if we train young people at the district level, the likelihood that they will remain there, that they will create linkage with the community, they will see the hospital as their own, integrate with the community, maybe get married, have kids, and remain in the community is very high. So fast forward 20 years, and about 70% of the COSEXA training hospitals are found in the district level. That's where trainings happen. So most of the training happens at the district hospital, where they see huge number of cases, where they operate on huge number of cases, good hands-on exposure, and then they have to visit, get attachments at better centers in the capital cities to do advanced care, like intensive care, critical care, subspecialty level training, pediatric surgery, plastic surgery, laparoscopic surgery. So COSEXA has exactly copied such a model, designed such a model. What probably is a bit different from what you described earlier is the training is actually based in a district hospital. The outreach is to the bigger hospitals. Mm. Whereas what universities follow is universities are based in capital cities, tertiary level or quaternary level hospitals. Trainees go out to the district for exposure. So I guess COSECs have flipped the model. And because
when you
of
say
this,
it like that, I feel like we have it backwards.
I think so. Because the data we generated in 2015 shows us that about 75% of our trainees, after they graduate, remained in the district, in the country they were trained, and about 92% remained in the region. The brain drain threat is significantly reduced. And COSECSA contributed a lot of surgeons so far to the continent by this model. So I completely agree with you. The district hospital is a good opportunity to train specialists. And I can now argue even medical students.
I feel like I've just had an illumination, to be honest. I just realized that we're training medical students and specialists in extremely specialized referral centers to do the highest, most modern medicine. You know, here we put patients on ECMO and we transplant mm-hmm. hearts and lungs. Mm-hmm. But how can they learn to treat the most basic abscess and pneumonia and, you know, snake bite for kind of your setting? It makes absolutely no sense. And maybe this approach by COSECSA is smart that way because it's a college and it's all inclusive versus, you're right, like we are training based on universities. And of course, universities are based in large urban centers. Yeah. That's just the reality of it. We have lots to learn.
What I can in fact add is that is why academic institutions need to be context-based and context-oriented. We are here to train doctors, surgeons who serve the community. By community, I mean Rwanda, the region, and Africa. The trainees and trainers should completely understand what they are dealing with. Yeah. If you take Canada in the US, once a medical student graduates, they don't independently practice. They go to residency, fellowship, and then they start independent practice. But Africa is probably years before that. Our graduates, our GPs, need to go back to the community and serve the community for several years because the need is enormous. Our surgeons need to go to the community, to the district hospitals, and treat the most basic surgical disease. By most basic, I'm talking about laparotomies, the sigmoid volvulus, appendicitis, the colon obstructed colon cancers, perforated urinal ulcers, fractures, compound and closed, benign prostatic hyperplasia. These are the most commonest diseases our surgeons have to deal with. And these are found in the district. So academic programs and academic policies in this part of the world need to balance the need to train the most sophisticated surgical professionals and doctors versus the professionals that deal with the commonest surgical diseases in the region. So that has to be taken very seriously. Copy-paste from the Western world would never work. It's a recipe for a disaster for the context we are in now.
I would advocate for copy-pasting from your world to our underserved areas. You know, we do have a largely urban population, but we still have about 30 to 40% of our population who are remote and isolated. And we struggle to provide adequate quality of care for them. And this is a model that would definitely work. Can I ask your opinion on something?
Absolutely, please. Okay.
In settings, because, you know, sub-Saharan Africa much more than I do. And like I said earlier, my only experience is with Doctors Without Borders or MSF. And what, you know, this organization does usually is actually come into an existing district hospital, support the surgical system and other services, of course, during violent conflict or during, you know, population displacements or any type of, you know, external situation that actually like impacted the healthcare system locally and provide care. it is not a training organization at all, and they don't have that mandate. They're just there to fill a need. I've worked with them twice, in DRC and Central African Republic, and those two places didn't have any local surgeons, and I ended up being, you know, the only white surgeon there, which is a little bit disheartening and doesn't feel good, to be honest. But what I'm trying to ask is, in those extreme examples, in those countries or regions where COSEXA is not present and there's basically no mechanism in place to train surgeons, and where MSF has actually built infrastructure and a high quality surgical program based on expat surgeons, how do you think we can actually approach potential capacity building in those sites? And I'll tell you one thing I was have been trying is actually partnering with them, between UBC and MSF, to try to create like a pilot training program for medical doctors in South Sudan to actually at least train them inside Chiwina District Hospital to do basic surgical procedures, like the ones you mentioned. So supporting those physicians using an MSF supported facility through a UBC created curriculum that's context relevant. But I guess my question is, like, is that first of all a right approach? And second of all, how do we link this back to the college, and how do we make this sustainable long-term and kind of fit into the big picture of the training you've talked about?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Emily. It's a rather complicated situation and question.
Yeah.
In my opinion, the first thing is the local governance, the leaders, the doctors, the community needs to take ownership of what is happening in their land. They should mm-hmm. recognize that their people are dying because of lack of access to care. Their people are dying because of lack of access to education. Their future is probably a bit dark because their youth are not being trained well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where leadership of a country, of a district comes into play. They mm-hmm. should, Africa should wake up and first recognize its own problems. Face it. You know, we can't hide from it. So the countries, the district, the hospitals need to wake up and first face the challenges in front of them. Mm-hmm. The second is, the world is a good place. There are very kind people around who share Africa's pain, who would really like to lend a hand, who would really like to work with Africa. And the key word is partnership.
Yeah.
There are many people, organizations, who would like to partner with Africa, with local institutions, develop, grow. And the partnership model we follow at UGH is a 7-staged model, starting from the stage of planning that ends with monitoring and evaluation and capacity building. Unless partnerships follow this complete cycle of development, they will fail eventually. They will fail. Partnership is a give and take. It's not just give, 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 or take, take, take. It's not a parachute medicine where, you know, a certain savior comes in, does the work, and goes back. It's non-sustainable. That is, in fact, disastrous to a region, a country, because it creates demand. It awakens the people. But the service is not available. So the local community should wake up. The leaders should wake up. Recognize the problems in their hands, think of their people, work for their own people, and design a system. The system that's designed when working with a partner can be achieved. One partner to this is COSEXA, for example. COSEXA is very willing to share all its resources, its curricula, its assessment format, its everything to accredit the hospitals in the country. Allow them to train, help them assess their students and accredit them. But there should be a local buy-in. And international partners like yourself, like your institution, come and fit yeah. there very well. Unless these are in place, particularly the local buy-in,
yeah.
I'm afraid it might not work. To put it boldly, it might not work.
Agreed.
Yeah.
No, I think that that's important to get that context, and things will move slow. And I guess the reason why I wanted to do something about it is, you know, you only have one life to live, and I refuse to keep doing MSF missions and feeling like I was barely just filling a gap and not building any capacity. So even though you're right, it's probably going to be a much longer run and lots of bumps in the road and failures, and until like there's an actual healthcare system that's built in local governance, it's not going to be sustainable. But I believe that at least giving some training through MSF is empowering to local physicians, and if you know they can just add this to their skill set and maybe save some patients' lives, it's it's one small victory. Do you mind a bit, could you share that 7 stages of partnership with us? Like, I would be really interested to see if we could implement that with our own partnerships. We've struggled in the past to actually find a framework for that, and that'd be helpful, especially coming from your institution.
Absolutely. I can email it for you, but just to give it a better context, we run our academic programs at UGHE with several academic partners, about 22 partners. The partners, for example, for surgery, there is one major partner in the US. The volunteer faculty sit with us from the planning phase. How long is it? When we write the curriculum, the syllabi, the everything. And then who's coming to teach? This week, I am in campus. One faculty from Harvard is with me. The two of us are teaching this week. Next week, we know who's coming to teach what, at what time. The roles of us, the local partner, the role of the international partners is very clear. There is an investment we put into the partnership. It might not be money. It might be opportunity for the US-based medical students or fellows or residents or even the faculty. There is investment the partners put in place. So our benefits are clearly put in place. And the underpinning is capacity building. Within a few years, our local surgeons, our local faculty will be able to teach the courses independently. So the heavy dependence on partners should gradually go down. We monitor and evaluate at the end, and we conclude the partnership. Partnership should have a start date and an end date. Otherwise, it's going to be dependent. So this is the model we follow when we design partnerships.
That's very useful. Thank you.
It's interesting you brought up the first things you brought up when you talked about it were monitoring, evaluation, and capacity building, because it seems to me the more people we talk to, the difference between a sustainable program and an unsustainable program just kind of has those three things: monitoring, evaluation, and long-term capacity building. To get a little more specific and just to kind of end off here, if you had to choose one actionable item with a clear bound time target, something that could advance surgical care in your country, what would it be?
I guess it would be training. We need to train as many people as we can. There is a huge demand in Africa. You know those very famous sentences in the global surgery campaigns. 5 billion people lack access to surgical care. Almost all of them are in Africa. You know, the SAO density is unmentionable in Africa. So the solution is to train. Use each and every district hospital in Africa. Train. Who knows, 10 years, 15 years from now, we may have enough surgeons, enough scrub nurses, enough anesthesia professionals, enough biomed technicians. But we need to start today.
Yeah.
Under training come partnerships. Let's do it together. Why should neighboring African countries struggle alone? Can't we do it together? Can we come under one umbrella? Under training come quality. It's not just operating, but outcomes should also be better. Under training come research. We should be based on our own or on our own data. Our curricula, our syllabi should be based on the local data. Continuous quality improvement, professional development also come under training. So if you ask me to select just one word, I would select training.
Thank you. And just to wrap up, first of all, I wanted to really thank you for your time. We really appreciate you taking time out of your extremely busy schedule to talk with us and educate us. Who would you recommend we host next on this podcast?
Well, first, thank you so much for inviting me. It's been exciting. I really enjoyed my conversations with you. There are many trainers, many dedicated global surgery advocates, care providers in Africa. I can recommend, particularly around training, I can recommend a colleague from Ethiopia, mm-hmm. probably the first cardiothoracic surgeon in Ethiopia, Dr. Dereje Gulelat.
Well, Dr. Bekele, great. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Omar, the pleasure is all mine. Thank you very much.
Maybe I think you'll hear more from us in the future. I know you already have 22 partners at your university, but maybe we could be the 23rd.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, That'd be great.
We're launching our Center for Global Surgery next week on Tuesday. Okay. I can share with you the announcement. So we definitely would love to partner with you. And
please send the announcement. Support. We can also post it on Twitter on our...
I will do that right now. I'll do that right now.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Emily. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you. Really nice seeing you. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to Off the Table, a global surgery podcast. Make sure to follow us on your favorite podcasting app and leave us a review. You can also find show notes and more information about past and future episodes on our website, www.patreon.com/offthetablepodcast. If you have comments or suggestions, you can email us at offthetablepod21@gmail.com or connect with us on Instagram, OTT_globalsurgery, and Twitter, offthetable_pod. We hope that you join us on our next episode.